So. Welcome everybody. This is the 11th lecture in my course on Tranquility and Insight. And we start again with some of the discussion in the forum. Thanks to all those who have contributed there. This is a question, a general question on methodology by Bhikkhu Arya Dhammika. Now, my question is, how far the differences in parallel versions can be regarded to be the outcome of individual reciter's mistakes? How strong is the influence of single reciter's mistakes on the permanent corruption of a text, implying that an individual's mistake would need to get repeated by future generations of reciters? In historical perspective, how could it still happen that the false memory of one person became the established way of reciting a text in that particular lineage of oral transmission? Yeah, this is a very interesting question. As far as my understanding goes, we have two influences on the oral transmission of these texts. One is the communal recitation, which tends to stabilize a text, but the other one is the teaching of recitation. And the teaching of recitation is usually done individually. One goes to an esteemed, usually a monk, in the early stages, perhaps also the nuns, to a recognized nun, to learn a particular text. And because in those old days they didn't have written material, the way this is done is like suppose you were there and you wanted to learn the Dhammapada with me. Then I would go, Manopubangama Dhamma Manosita Manomaya. And then you would have to repeat, Manopubangama Dhamma Manomaya Manosita. And then I teach you the next line and the next line until you got enough for today. And you go off, or even if you are a whole group and learning with me, you go off and recite it by yourself until you can do it well. And then the whole group comes and you do a group recitation in front of me. I watch, I check if anybody goes wrong, and then I teach you the next chapter. But because you're learning it from a single person, if I make a mistake, like, as you know, our Anaya has not done his Dhammapada learning properly and he's jumbling up all the verses, then all of you will learn the version the way I remember it, with my mistakes. And so if we imagine the whole situation in India, at all times, in different places and different areas, different monasteries, the reciters will be learning slightly different versions of the texts. And it depends on how many disciples, okay, let me take my case again, how many disciples our Anarya is able to gather around himself, whether his version of the Dhammapada will continue to be transmitted by them. If everybody finds out that Anarya hasn't even learned the Dhammapada properly, he's forgetting half of it, I went to another monastery, they do it quite differently, then my version of the Dhammapada will probably not be continued. But if I am becoming a very famous reciter, and many people say, oh, I learned it from Anarya, he's very precise, he's a very good reciter, and my students become reciting teachers by their own, then my version will get perpetuated. In this way, an error that originally may have been made only by me can continue down the lines of transmission. This is a question by Anne Dillon. A question persists as I have been reflecting on the Kayagata Sati Sutta parallels, the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapana Sati Sutta, both as texts and as meditation practices. I'm wondering about the original term or terms behind the English translation of body, body of breath, pervading the body. Is Kaya the original word in all cases? Or might there be other Pali terms which lose their nuance when translated into English as simply body? The Kaya Upasana contemplations of the Satipatthana Sutta are fairly clear in pointing to the material body, but other instances are less clear. Do the Pali texts offer a more nuanced understanding of what is meant by the terms experiencing the whole body and pervading the whole body, for instance? Yeah, the problem, and this came up already in a question posed by Akinchano last session, that the term kaya, in all these instances, the term used is kaya, and the term kaya can mean the physical body, but it can also mean an aggregate or something whole. It can have a more general sense. So it's a little bit based on the context and the usage elsewhere in the Pali discourses that we have to determine the meaning. And another possibility is to look at what the commentary says, and another possibility is to look at what the Chinese translators understood at the time when they were translating it, which still is some 1,500 or even more years closer to the original than we are nowadays. Now, there are instances where kaya clearly does not mean the body, and these are related to meditation. And this is usually the word kaya there occurs in the instrumental, and the expressions are kayena pusati, touching through the body with the body, or kayena sachikaroti, through the body with the body realizing. And these expressions are used for the immaterial attainments and for nirvana. And in both cases, we can be fairly sure that this does not mean with the body. You cannot experience or touch an immaterial attainment with the body, because the very fact that it is immaterial means there is no matter there anymore. So in these instances, it means with one's whole being. As far as the Kayagatasati Sutta is concerned, however, since these are the same exercise as in the Satipatthana Sutta, and it doesn't use the instrumental in this sense, I think we can be fairly sure that it means the physical body. With the third and fourth step of the mindfulness of breathing in the 16th step, it's obviously a matter of discussion. And I think there are two possible interpretations. One is the proposed usually by the Theravada commentary tradition, that this idea of experiencing the whole body refers to the whole body of the breath. So it means with the third step to be aware from the breath from beginning to end. And this is a very valuable interpretation. However, I believe it is also possible, and this is the one I personally favor, there is an alternative interpretation that understands this to refer to the whole physical body. And just recently, when preparing for my new Satipatthana book, I discovered that the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing have a parallel not only in the Samyukta Agama of the Mula Savastivada tradition, but also in the Mahasanghika Vinaya. And the Mahasanghika Vinaya, the Chinese, is very clear that they understood it to refer to the whole physical body. But this is a controverted point, so there is not one correct interpretation here, and I think both really make sense. It depends a little bit on what edge one takes on mindfulness of breathing, I believe. If one uses mindfulness of breathing predominantly as a vehicle for developing tranquility and deeper concentration, then this very minute focus on the entire breath without losing it, when one is developing this whole focus aspect, it's very meaningful to understand sabbakaya patisangvedi, to experience the whole body of the breath. But if one sees the mindfulness of breathing in the 16th step to be more about sati, about mindfulness in the sense of satipatthana and opening up to various aspects of experience, which is the approach that I personally favor, but this doesn't need to be the only right one, then it would fit more to think of it in terms of the whole physical body, coming from the experience of the breath sensation to be aware of any other kind of sensation in the body. Then there's a comment by Linda Grace on the three similes of mindfulness of the body, which we have in the Pali version, but we do not have them in the Madhyama Agama parallel. And so she says the previous similes, which are found in both versions, while the previous similes in both versions are so expressive in describing how Mara either can or cannot find an opportunity or support, the additional three build upon them in showing the power and skill of a mind cultivated through mindfulness of the body to such a degree that Mara cannot penetrate. with the image of how a strong man can tip over a full jug of water or loosen an embankment surrounding a full pond of water such that water flows out, and how a skilled charioteer can drive out and back by any road wherever he likes. They further illustrate how this energy can be harnessed. Yeah, I just wanted to share this with you because I thought that was a very important aspect that I had so far not really seen, understood myself being made by these additional similes found only in the Pali version. Now I come to the topic of contemplation of death. And we had the advantage that Bhikkhu Arya Dhammika has been offering us some nice pictures on the forum so that one can get a very vivid sense of what it looks like when a corpse falls apart. And there's a few additional suggestions by Kim Allen and Shaila Catherine how this kind of practice could be put into practice, and I've just summarized them for all of us, going from the very simple to the more demanding type. So one possibility would be that we reflect on any of the possessions we have who have been given to us by somebody who has passed away in the meantime. This is a very simple thing that can help us to reflect on the fact that, look, this cup has been given to me by so-and-so, and he or she has passed away. I'm also going to pass away. It's just something very, very immediate in our environment that we can use. And another suggestion was to make a point of really noticing whenever we walk or drive past a mortuary or a cemetery, that there is an inherent, innate, usual tendency to not pay attention to this and to make a conscious effort to be very conscious. This is a mortuary, this is a cemetery, it's meant for this and this purpose, and I'm also going to end up there. And another suggestion was when we are driving out on the road, when we see a roadkill, which happens quite regularly, at least here in this part where I live in Germany, there's a lot of animals in the forest, and one often sees an animal run over by the roadside, to immediately put in that reflection, my body will be like that too. And then if one feels ready to step up, one could also volunteer at a hospice, or it is even possible to see a human dissection at a hospital. I have done that in Sri Lanka, and I found that very useful. This is now from Shaila Catherine on contemplation of death. I'm giving it in several parts. So she says, on the practice, to observe the breath as though it is the last breath. This adds an interesting dimension to Anapanasati and clearly enhances the sense of urgency, but it seems to function very differently than contemplating a decomposing corpse or imagining my body devoured by animals and insects, dismembered or worn away by the elements until it is reduced to dust. The repulsive quality and graphic detail involved in contemplating a decomposing corpse has a very different effect on my mind than contemplating the cessation of this life with the cessation of this breath. I remember that the Buddha encouraged diligence through recognizing that we could die before the next exhalation or before he had swallowed the food that was being chewed. Yeah, I recommend this on purpose because I believe that approaching death in this way is less challenging and goes more directly to the actual topic. The thing is, the decomposing corpses and the body devoured by animals and insects, first of all, for many practitioners, it is rather challenging to engage in this kind of ideas. And to my knowledge, also the cemetery contemplations are not really the most popular kind of meditation taught in the West nowadays. And for some, there could also be a tendency to almost start enjoying this kind of gorgy aspect of it, to almost find start to delight in that. It's a kind of the opposite of sensual desire, but still some form of almost sensual engagement with it. Well, this is putting it too strong, but there is an. I have seen it with some monks in my personal experience, in my circle of friends, that there is a way of engaging with it that somehow gets around the real problem. The real problem is to simply, blandly, quietly acknowledge the fact that I am going to die. And this can happen any time. It could happen right now. Oof. This much is quite enough. And if this is done with sustainedly, the mind will find a peacefulness in that, a peacefulness in accepting death. And then at that point, when one has come to that, then these goji pictures can be brought in to sometimes sharpen attention if the mind doesn't fully take in the fact of death. But in my personal experience, this is the way I suggest practice to evolve. And we should also be clear that the cemetery contemplations are not explicitly presented as a contemplation of death. This is our interpretation, and I think it's correct, but the recommendation given for Marana Anusati, the recollection of death, are precisely those that I mentioned last time and that Chala also mentioned, with the breath and with when one was eating the next, I'm not sure if I can take the next bit of food. And this is still Chala Catherine. However, using the breath as an approach to contemplating death seems to be very different than exploring the four tetras in the Anapanasati instructions. Would you kindly speak a bit more about the observation of the impermanence of the breath as an approach to Maranasati practice? And also expand on the relationship between the meditations on death and the insight into the mark of impermanence. Why did you emphasize impermanence in this meditation rather than the dukkha or anatta characteristics, which often seem to be to me to be quite vivid when exploring this? Yeah, so recollection of death is not a form of Anapanasati, that's correct. Its purpose is to use the breath merely as a tool to recollect death. It's just as we have the recollection of the impure or unbeautiful aspect of the body and the recollection of the first two elements or the contemplation of the first two elements, they use the same bodily parts. It's exactly the same list, but still they are different exercises. So here we are using the breath, but the object of our practice is not the breath itself, much rather it is the recollection of death. So it is natural that these are different practices. And as far as the three characteristics are concerned, and I've written on this in a paper on the dynamics of insight, I think, and the development of insight in two papers, there's a progression of the three main characteristics in insight practice, where first one establishes insight into impermanence. When impermanence is clearly seen, the conclusion, the meditative conclusion is drawn, as it changes, it cannot give me lasting satisfaction. It means it is dukkha. And then again the meditative conclusion is drawn, as it cannot give me lasting satisfaction, it is meaningless for me to latch on to it as I, me and mine. And I think this meditative sequence has a lot of meaning. There are some who find it more natural to approach things directly from the dukkha and from the anatta or sunyata, emptiness perspective, and that is fine. But my personal understanding is that it is good if we can balance out our approach so that the other two characteristics are also seen. And here I think in particular of those who have a strong leaning towards anatta and emptiness, with some, not with all, but with some, there can be a problem that the dukkha is not seen or that the impermanence is not seen. And in order to bring in all characteristics, I think it is meaningful to follow this basic sequence and build up from impermanence and then dukkha, and then anatta or sunyata. And this is why I am bringing in impermanence as the first point and basic point. And within this sequence, one can obviously place one's emphasis whichever way one prefers. And it's also perfectly fine to do sometime emptiness meditation, like in the Majjhima Nikaya 121. And maybe when this naturally comes to an end, then just add this little dose of, oh, this also has changed, and oh, this also cannot give me lasting satisfaction. Just to make sure that the beautiful flavor of deep experience of one of the characteristics does not make us miss out on one or two of the others. I'm still with Shaila, but now we are moving on to the cricket discourse, Majjhima Nikaya 82. The cricket discourse is filled with valuable reminders and warnings for serious meditators who embrace jhana as a part of the liberating path. We may intellectually understand that jhanas are merely temporary conditioned states, but the dangers that befell Venerable Citta Hattisariputta continue to be present among practitioners today. Exhilarated with minor attainments, meditators risk overestimating the significance and durability of their experiences. Tinged by conceit, meditators might seek recognition, much like Venerable Citta Hattisariputta's attempt to assert himself into the discussion of the elders. Apparently, Venerable Citta Hattisariputta ordained and disrobed several times in the course of his practice. His story reminds me that continued diligence is required to reach the goal and to not stop until we are seeing things as they really are. I appreciate this discourse that inspires continued diligence. And she adds, I feel, and I have found this very powerful, I feel that the richness of jhana practice is not found in the pleasure and peace experienced while abiding in concentrated states, but in the skills that are developed through this meditative training, skills that are used to realize liberating insight. As such, jhana is not about attaining experiences, but about developing the mind. Yeah, I was very touched by this. Very beautiful. There's a very beautiful comment also by Kim Allen, and I would like to save that until we come to the end of today's lecture. I think it's a very nice way for us to conclude. So unless there are any questions on the things that we quickly went through from the forum, we could delve into the first of our discourses. We have four discourses in front of us today. All are very short, and the last one is not really related to our topic, so there should not be any problem in getting through in time. So in case you have any questions now or in between, please feel very welcome to just type them into the chat box. The discourse we are going to look at now deals with the problem, the only one of the five hindrances that I find very difficult to handle or to teach others how to handle: drowsiness. It's a very difficult one. The others are, to me, so clear, but how to deal with my own drowsiness when I feel drowsy and how to help students who have drowsiness to get out of it is something that is still a puzzle to me. I need to note that the Pali parallel here and elsewhere, I follow the numbering of the PTS edition. Bhikkhu Bodhi gives this as 7.61. And I forgot to mention also that last lecture, what I give as Anguttara Nikaya 660, according to PTS, is 661 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. It's a little unfortunate that we don't have a way of cross-referencing this. I think we maybe should put up something on the internet that somebody who gets one type of reference can easily find the other one. So let us look at the discourse. Then the Venerable Maha Moggallana, who was practicing meditation in a secluded and quiet place, was dozing off. This kind of, you have probably experienced it yourself and seen it many others, sitting in meditation and then you The Blessed One realized from afar that the Mahamoggallana, who was practicing meditation in a secluded and quiet place, was dozing off. Having realized this, the Blessed One entered a type of concentration such that by means of it, just as a strong man might bend or stretch his arm, he disappeared from the deer park at Visakala Grove on Crocodile Hill among the Baggas and appeared before the Venerable Mahamoggallana at the village of Kalvalamutta in the country of Magadha. Then the Blessed One emerged from that concentrated state and said, Mahamoggallana, you are stuck in sleepiness, you are stuck in sleepiness. The Venerable Mahamoggallana said to the Blessed One, yes indeed, Blessed One. The Buddha said further, Mahamoggallana, whatever sign makes you become stuck in sleepiness, do not develop that sign, do not make much of it. In this way the sleepiness may be overcome. So the first suggestion he's giving us is change your meditation practice. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should recite in full the teachings as you have earlier heard them and as you have memorized them. In this way the sleepiness may be overcome. So the next is recitation, which is still a meditative task, but it involves some more effort and then a part of the mind that is related to more conceptual understanding and thus stirs up energy. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should explain in full to others the teachings as you have earlier heard them and as you have memorized them. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. So even if I was sleepy 10 minutes ago, now sitting in front of you, I can't really get off like this because I'm talking. It's a good way to get out of it. If your former sleepiness has not been overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should ponder and reflect in your mind on the teachings as you have earlier heard them and as you have memorized them. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. Excuse me. So this is mental reflection. It seems a little bit out of sequence here. One would have expected mental reflection to come at a point before one actually starts to talk about the Dharma, which is a more extroverted kind of activity. If your former sleepiness has not been overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should pull your ears with both hands. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should bathe your face and eyes with cold water and sprinkle your body with it. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. So here now, there's physical actions are being taken. Splash some water into the face, pull your ears. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should go out of the dwelling, look to the four directions and gaze up at the constellations. In this way the sleepiness may be overcome, so now he's going outside. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should go out of the dwelling, go in front of it and practice walking meditation out in the open, with your sense faculties guarded and the mind quietly established within, being perceptive of what is in front and behind. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. So now is walking meditation. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should leave off walking meditation, go to the end of the meditation part, spread your sitting mat, and sit down cross-legged. In this way, the sleepiness may be overcome. I don't understand this. If for some reason your sleepiness is not overcome, Mahamoggallana, you should go back into the dwelling, fold your outer robe in four and spread it on the bed. Fold the inner robe to use as a pillow and lie down on your right side, one foot on the other, arousing the perception of light in the mind, establishing right mindfulness and right comprehension, constantly with the thought of rising again. Yeah, I don't understand in the sequence when one has come to the point that one is doing walking meditation and still feeling sleepy, how then just sitting down and meditating may help the sleepiness. In fact, in my own experiments with drowsiness, I found that walking meditation is not a good idea, because even though doing walking meditation, I will not be drowsy. When I sit down after that, I'm definitely going to fall asleep. It doesn't work for me. In an Anguttara Nikaya parallel, we have 8 recommendations and we find that after the 7th practice, walking meditation, the last one is then really that one realizes I'm just too tired to meditate properly and let me better take a rest. And after I've taken rest, I start again. So the 8 recommendations given here is first of all avoid the perception that has led to sleepiness. That means we change the meditation practice. Then reflect on the teachings, and then recite the teachings. This also seems to me a more meaningful sequence. Just reflecting mentally is a more subtle kind of activity than reciting, and certainly more subtle than actually teaching to others. Then pull the ears and rub the limbs, clean the eyes with water and look at the constellation, develop perception of light, and practice walking meditation and lie down. Perception of light, we didn't have at all in the Chinese, if I remember correctly. Yeah, perception of light is also one where I have a little difficulty to understand Alokasanya, because, I mean, if it refers to external light, then that makes sense. Like switching on the light, or if one is out in nature, to sit out in a bright place instead of in the dark. But Alokasanya usually refers to inner perceptions of light, and inner perception of light, as we discussed in the when we were there with the Upakkhilesa Sutta, our experience related to samatha, to tranquility. And so I do not fully understand how these can help one to come out of sleepiness. But perception of light is among the standard description of the antidotes to sloth and torpor. So maybe there's just a shortcoming in my own understanding. But if I leave aside the things that I find difficult or do not really understand, then what I come to is a very simple progression. First of all, if I notice that I'm drowsy, change the meditation practice. And meaningful, obviously, to change from a very relaxed and receptive form of meditation to something that is a little bit more energizing. And if that doesn't work, then get the conceptual mind going, reflect. And if that doesn't work, then recite the teachings aloud. And at that point, then physical action is needed. Pulling the ears, I found that actually quite useful. Or a little bit like rubbing the body. And I don't have water close by my meditation seat, so I can't clear the eyes with water. I would have to stand up for that. But then the next thing would be to stand up and try to do something, splash water into the face and do walking meditation. And then there's a point where one realizes, I'm simply tired. Maybe I ate too much, or last night I didn't sleep well enough. And then one just lies down and rests for a little while. Yeah, then after giving us these different methods on how to deal with drowsiness, the Anguttara version directly gets into the topic of how one should behave, or Mahamoggallana should behave when he goes to beg alms. And the Madhyama Agama version is a little more detailed and gives a somewhat more smoother transition to this topic. I remember when reading the Anguttara discourse, I was sometimes a little bit stuck at this somewhat sudden shift of topic, at least so it seemed to me. And with the Madhyama Agama now, I see more how the drowsiness connects to the other behavior. So after giving the advice that if one is so drowsy that one lies down to sleep, one should, however, not indulge in that. This is right away the next point. Because there can sometimes be this, especially when one does a self-retreat and one doesn't have a schedule enforced by others and nobody will notice, there is this waking up and thinking, well, you know, if I just stay another half an hour, then my meditation will be much better. Well, and after half an hour, I don't have to continue, you can imagine yourself. So the Buddha, quite aware of this, Mahamoggallana, do not indulge in reclining peacefully in bed. And do not desire gain, do not be attached to fame. Why not? I shall tell you all the conditions that one should not associate with, and shall tell you those that one should associate with. Mahamoggallana, which are the conditions that I say one should not associate with? Mahamoggallana, close association with conditions of the common worldly way. Such conditions, I say, one should not associate with. Mahamoggallana, by close association with conditions of the common worldly way, there will be much talk. If there's much talk, there's agitation. If there's agitation, the mind is not at ease. And these common worldly ways, I understand, go from finding it nice to just hang out in bed and be lazy to desiring gain, being attached to fame, etc. Mamogalana, if the mind is not at ease, then the mind is bereft of concentration. For this reason, Mamogalana, I say that one should not associate with these. Excuse me. Mamogalana, what conditions do I say that one should associate with? Mamogalana, secluded places. With these conditions, I say one should associate beneath trees and mountain forests, empty and peaceful places, high crags and rock caves without noise, farewell places free of evil, free of people, places conducive to meditation. Mahamogalana, with these conditions I say that one should associate. And now comes the issue of begging for alms food when one lives in such a secluded place. Mahamogalana, if you enter the village to beg for alms food, you should do so disenchanted with gain, disenchanted with offerings, disenchanted with worship. Only when your mind has become disenchanted with gain, offerings and worship should you enter the village to beg alms food. Yeah, if I read that instruction earlier, I don't think I would have gotten much food while I was a monk in Sri Lanka. Mahamogalana, do not enter the village to beg alms food with a proud state of mind. Why not? Householder families are busy with household affairs, such that when a monk comes begging alms food, a householder may not pay attention to him. Then the monk thinks, who has spoiled my relationship with the householder in this house? Why? When I entered the householder's house, the householder does not pay attention to me. Because of this, sadness arises. Because of sadness, there's agitation. Because of agitation, the mind is not at ease. And because the mind is not at ease, the mind is bereft of concentration. Mahamogalana, when you teach the Dharma, do not speak in a criticizing way. If there is criticism, there will be much talk. Because of much talk, agitation arises. Because of agitation, the mind is not at ease. And because the mind is not at ease, the mind is bereft of concentration. Mahamogalana, when you teach the Dharma, do not speak trying to better others, but teach the Dharma unruffled like a lion. Mahamogalana, when you teach the Dharma, teach it humbly. Abandon force, extinguish force, destroy force. Teach the Dharma without trying to better others. Teach the Dharma unruffled like a lion. Mahamogalana, you should train like this. So it's in all these different ways pointing at concentration, at how one, in the setting of a traditional monk in ancient India, the life can be structured in such a way that all becomes contributive to the cultivation of tranquility. And after this teaching on tranquility, now Mahamogalana wants to know about insight. At that time, the Venerable Mahamogalana rose from his seat, arranged his robes so as to bare one shoulder, placed his palms together in respect towards the Buddha and said, Blessed One, how does a monk attain the ultimate purity, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate completion of the holy life? The Blessed One said, Mahamogalana, whether they are pleasant feelings, painful feelings, or neutral feelings, a monk contemplates such pleasant feelings, painful feelings, and neutral feelings as impermanent. He contemplates their rise and fall, their eradication, their fading away, their cessation, and their abandonment. Having contemplated feelings as impermanent, having contemplated their rise and fall, their eradication, their fading away, their cessation, their abandonment, he does not cling to this world. Because of not clinging to the world, he is not worried. Because of not being worried, he attains final nirvana and he knows as it really is. Birth has ended, the holy life has been established, what was to be done has been done, there will not be another existence. Mahamogalana, in this way a monk attains the ultimate purity, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate completion of the holy life. Yeah, according to the Pali commentary on the Anguttara Nikaya parallel, it was based on this instruction that Venerable Mahamoggallana became an arahant. And this clearly puts a spotlight on contemplation of feeling. Contemplating feeling as the point where independent arising, craving arises, and instead of letting them give rise to craving, develop detachment by seeing them as impermanent. So, the three main points that I suggest we can take along from this discourse is, first of all, the methodology for overcoming drowsiness. Then the attitude that is conducive to tranquility, humility, not being overcritical, and to live a life that gives place to seclusion. And the point on insight, to contemplate the impermanent nature of feelings, to become free from clinging. If there are no specific questions to this discourse, I would continue with the next one. Good, the discourse on being without thorns. So there's an introductory narration according to which the Lichavis of Vaisali want to come to visit the Buddha. And we set in after this has become known in the community. Then the well-known virtuous senior elders, the great disciples, heard that the Lichavis of Vaisali, with their great power and royal might, and with loud singing, were coming out of Vaisali to approach the Buddha and pay their respects. They thought, noise is a thorn to meditative absorption. The Blessed One has declared that noise is a thorn to meditative absorption. Let us rather go to the Gosinga Grove. Staying there, we will be without disturbance, staying secluded and alone to sit and meditate. Then the well-known virtuous senior elders, the great disciples, went to the Gosinga Grove. There, without disturbance, they stayed secluded and alone to sit and meditate. And then comes another part of the discourse that then explains or reports how the Lichavis indeed came, making a loud clamor and a lot of noise, and the Buddha then gave them a talk on the Dharma. And they were very happy about the talk, and they left again. So, soon after the Lichavis from Vaisali had left, the Blessed One asked the monks, "Where have the senior elders, the great disciples, gone?" The monks replied, "Blessed One, the senior elders, the great disciples, heard that the Lichavis of Vaisali, with their great power and royal might and with loud singing, were coming out of Vaisali to approach the Buddha and pay their respects. They thought, noise is a thorn to absorption. The Blessed One has declared that noise is a thorn to absorption. Let us rather go to the Gosinga Grove. Staying there, we will be without disturbance, staying secluded and alone, to sit and meditate." Blessed One, the senior elders, the great disciples all went there together. I need to mention that the names of these disciples are given in the Chinese and the Pali, and these are names that we usually do not hear so often. They are not the elders that we usually come across in the suttas. On hearing this, the Blessed One praised them, saying, it is well, that the senior elders, the great disciples, should speak like this. Noise is a thorn to absorption. The Blessed One has declared that noise is a thorn to absorption. Why? I do indeed speak like this. To absorption, this is indeed a thorn. I think we have to place this slightly into context. It is meaningful to try to establish conditions for meditation practices where there is as least inference from the outside as possible. But once one has done that much, then one also needs to be able to deal with whatever happens. It's quite contrary to a meditation practice, whether this is tranquility or insight, if one sits in meditation and then gets upset about the fact that others are disturbing my meditation by making noise or whatever. Still, the fact is that for going into absorption attainment, noise can become a problem. And this is what is being thematized in this discourse. So now the discourse continues in both versions by giving a list of thorns to make it clear what the idea of a thorn refers to. To one who is maintaining morality, breaches of morality are a thorn. To one guarding the senses, bodily adornments are a thorn. To one cultivating the perception of foulness, an appearance of purity is a thorn. To one cultivating loving kindness, anger is a thorn. To one abstaining from liquor, the drinking of liquor is a thorn. To a monk leading the celibate life, looking at the female form is a thorn. To one entering the first absorption, noise is a thorn. To one entering the second absorption, directed awareness and sustained contemplation are a thorn. To one entering the third absorption, rapture is a thorn. To one entering the fourth absorption, the in-breath and out-breath are a thorn. To one entering the sphere of boundless space, perception of form is a thorn. To one entering the sphere of boundless consciousness, perception of the sphere of boundless space is a thorn. To one entering the sphere of nothingness, perception of the sphere of boundless consciousness is a thorn. And to one entering the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, perception of the sphere of nothingness is a thorn. To one entering the concentration by the cessation of perception and knowing are a thorn. Again, there are three thorns, the thorn of desire, the thorn of anger, the thorn of delusion. An arahant who has eradicated the influxes has already cut off these three thorns, knowing that they have been pulled out by the root and destroyed, so that they will not arise again. That is, an arahant is without thorns. An arahant is separate from thorns. An arahant is without thorns, separate from thorns. Thus spoke the Buddha, and the monks heard what the Buddha said, delighted it, and remembered it well. The listing of thorns we get in the Anguttara Nikaya version is as follows. So, socializing is a thorn for seclusion. The notion of beauty is a thorn for one who contemplates the absence of beauty. Entertainments are a thorn for sense restraint. Company with women is a thorn for a male who lives the celibate life. Sound is a thorn for the first jhana, vitaka vichara for the second, rapture for the third, and the breath for the fourth jhana. And perception and feeling are a thorn for the cessation attainment. And desire, anger, and delusion are thorns that an arahant has overcome. So we see pretty much the same trajectory. The immaterial spheres are here not mentioned. As I said, this often happens in presentations. And it all leads up from very simple kind of thorns to the idea that an arahant can overcome those thorns that are really of crucial importance, the thorn of desire, anger, and delusion. Now, one thing I would like to briefly comment on is the fact that in the Anguttara Nikaya version number 5, qualification of the first jhana as being a thorn if there is sound. This is another controversial topic, and if I would have listened well to the previous discourse, I would not get into this because probably going to get a lot of controversy on this, and then this is going to be difficult for my concentration, I suppose, and I'm not yet an arahant, but I think I should still mention. Yeah, there's a lot of controversy nowadays on what actually is a jhana, what qualifies for a jhana. And I understand that there is a very sincere wish to make the teachings accessible to everybody who is interested. And there's also well-founded skepticism of the traditional interpretations offered by Buddha Gosa, and the commentary traditions as not always necessarily reflecting the original descriptions and also not always necessarily being the expression of actual meditative wisdom. However, I think this discourse gives a very clear indication that, and we call this now sutta jhana, the jhana that is described in the suttas was seen as not being compatible with the sustained hearing of sound. Otherwise, sound would not be a thorn, comparable to the other jhana factors in the list as we go down. If there is vitakka and vichara, which we also have in the Chinese, just translated differently, then it is not really the second jhana. And if there is rapture, then it is not really the third jhana. So if one hears sound continuously, then however much one may have a very profound, concentrated experience, it does not really seem to qualify as the first jhana, the way this is described in the discourses. And there's one passage which is important to keep in mind, to contextualize this. This is from the Vinaya, the Uttari Manusa Dhamma Parajika, the fourth offense involving defeat, about claims to having Uttari Manusa Dhamma, supernatural an attainment, a state that is beyond what is normal for humans. And there's the Venerable Mahamoggallana, and he says, so he's at this at this river, and he says, Ananjang Samadhi Samapanno, I had attained Aninja Samadhi, the imperturbable concentration. And you all know, we all know now from our discussion, imperturbable concentration means either the fourth jhana or an immaterial attainment. And he was hearing elephants as they made noise by splashing into the water. And the monks are really upset on hearing Mahamoggallana saying this. They say, wow, how can he say that? He must be parajika. He's making a false claim to a supernatural Uttari Manusa Dhamma, a state beyond what is capable, normal for humans. So this reaction by the monks confirms that they had the same understanding of jhana as we have here. They thought, even first jhana, you don't hear sound. How can he say he's in the fourth jhana and hearing sound? It's impossible. And so the monks go to the Buddha and they tell the Buddha, look what he said. And the Buddha says, no, he's not a parajika. Look, his concentration was not purified, aparisuddha. And the commentary explains that basically he emerged momentarily from the concentration and then heard the sound and then re-entered the concentration. So this puts the specification on sound a little bit into context. If someone intermittently for a short moment hears sound, then this does not necessarily mean that the entire experience this meditator has is not a jhana, but it could be a jhana and a very quick emerging from it and then dipping back into it. I had used the simile of being in the water in the course last year. So if I jump into the water and I'm all up to here in the water and I just pop out my head for a moment and then sink in back, then during that moment I'll be able to hear somebody calling, Ananya, come out, it's enough time now, we go. And then I go back in under the water, I won't be able to clearly hear. And we would still say Ananya was in the water when I told him, come on, get out. Even though, technically speaking, 100% correct, for a moment my head was not in the water. And so we can understand, hopefully with this simile, the point I'm trying to make is that a jhana attainment, it's not like a box with a very clear limit. Either it's something is ill, like my cup, either the water is in the cup or it's outside. But it's more like moving up the slope of a mountain, where you have an area where there's forest, where you have an area where there's bushes, and you have an area where there's only rocks, and you have an area where there's only snow. And the transition from one to the next is not a sharp line. There's a certain place where the trees become less and less, bushes become more, maybe just one or two trees, and eventually there's really no more trees and just bushes, etc. So jhana attainment could be compared to something like that. But it should be clear also from the reaction of the monks to Moggallana's claim that this understanding was a general understanding in the ancient Indian community of disciples. And we could also keep in mind that in Samyutta Nikaya elsewhere we find a whole series of suttas where Mahamoggallana says that his attainment, his progression through the jhanas, he always kind of needed the help of the Buddha. His clarity, this is a symbol, I mean, we don't know what historically these people were like, but we know the way they are depicted, and in the early discourses when Mahamoggallana is depicted as somebody who has a lot of meditative power, but he doesn't seem, he's not associated with this analytical clarity that is associated with Venerable Sariputta. So from this description we get the impression that he would not have been a person who had this absolute clarity, okay, now I'm in the first and now I need to let go of this and I know I get to get into the second. And this would also explain why he in this Vinaya passage thinks that he is actually hearing the sound while he is in the fourth jhana, or at least he's presenting it in that way, that he was not really clear about this momentary dipping out and in that apparently had happened there. So the main point of this discourse, as far as I can see, is the gradual procedure to become free from thorns, as we can see here from socializing, and sense restraint, and then absorption, and then finally the removal of defilements. So the gradual procedure to become free from thorns, which leads from seclusion and restraint via jhana to full liberation. Van Horn asks, can you describe more fully why the breath is a thorn to the fourth jhana? Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and there is a discussion on that. Some take it to mean that the breath actually really stops. I am not sure about this. I was told this is possible. I have not seen it, but I was told that there are some yogic in India and they get into very deep concentration and you can put them under water and after a few hours take them out again and nothing has happened to them. Another interpretation is that one simply doesn't feel the breath anymore. And that is also possible, but it seems to me that from the way jhana is usually described, it would be difficult to imagine that even with the lower jhanas, one really fully experiences the breath. So this is a passage you have pinpointed me on, a point where I'm not entirely sure how to interpret that. But we have it somewhere else that attaining the fourth jhana, asasa pasasa niruddhahanti, I don't remember the passage nor where it is, but that one who has attained the fourth absorption, in-breath and out-breath have ceased. So it seems to be the traditional understanding as far as I can tell, but perhaps in the forum somebody else will be able to correct me or say something more, is that the breath actually ceases. And it definitely ceases with the attainment of cessation, where not only the breath, but the human body is said to be as if dead, but unmovable until the person emerges from the cessation of perception and feeling. Yeah, could you ask that question? Let us see if maybe somebody either in the group here or on the forum will have further information on that. I still have to get there to know myself. So the next discourse on the true person, the Sampurisa. At that time, the Blessed One said to the monks, I will now teach you the nature of a true person and the nature of an untrue person. Listen closely, and pay careful attention. Then the monks listened to receive instruction. The Buddha said, what is the nature of an untrue person, asapuddhisam. Suppose that a certain man who had gone forth to practice the path is from an aristocratic family, while others are not. Because of being from an aristocratic family, he praises himself and looks down on the others. This is the nature of an untrue person. One who has the nature of a true person reflects like this. It is not because of being from an aristocratic family that I eradicate desire, anger and delusion. Suppose that a man who has gone forth to practice the path is not from an aristocratic family, but he practices the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma, follows the Dharma, keeps the direction of the Dharma, and progresses in step with the Dharma. Because of this, he should receive support and respect. If advancing in this way, he attains the true Dharma without praising himself or looking down on others, then this is the nature of a true person. Yeah, so the whole topic of this discourse is the issue of conceit, of creating a sense of ego, and this is the way of the asapurisa, and the sapurisa, the true person, is one who does not create such a sense of ego, but gives priority to the practice. And then the discourse works through several qualities. So other qualities could be that somebody is handsome and likable, while others are not. Then suppose somebody is eloquent and competent in talking, while others are not. Or suppose a certain man is of long standing. Long standing here refers to ordination. Known to the king, recognized by the people, and of great merit, while others are not. Again, suppose a certain one is one who recites the discourses, has memorized the Vinaya, and is learned in the Abhidharma. One who is versed in the Agamas, very learned in the collection of discourses, while others are not. Yeah, the reference to the Abhidharma seems to be a later intrusion. It's not found in the parallel. And the Abhidharma, historically, is a later collection. And it seems that in the course of the transmission of the Madhyama Agama, this additional reference was brought in. Then suppose that a certain man wears rag robes, limits himself to three robes, and possesses unpretentious robes, while others do not. Or somebody always observes the practice of begging for alms food, consistently accepts just 5 measures of rice, begs food at no more than 7 houses, eats only once per day, and abstains from thick drinks afternoon, while others do not. Again, suppose a certain man dwells in secluded places, beneath a tree in a mountain forest, or on a high crag, or out in the open, or in a cemetery, and that he is capable of knowing the proper time for staying in such places, while others are not. So after all these different aspects of conduct, now we get meditation attainments. Again, suppose that a certain man attains the first absorption, while others do not. Because of attaining the first absorption, he praises himself and looks down on others. This is the nature of an untrue person. One who has the nature of a true person reflects like this. The Blessed One has said that the first absorption is of an immeasurable type. If someone measures it, then that is clinging. Because of this attainment, he should receive support and respect. If advancing in this way, he attains the true Dharma without praising himself or looking down on others, then this is the nature of a true person. Again, suppose that a certain man attains the second, third and fourth absorption, the sphere of boundless space, boundless consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception, while others do not. Because of attaining the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, he praises himself and looks down on others. This is the nature of an untrue person. One who has the nature of a true person reflects like this. The Blessed One has said that the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception is of an immeasurable type. If someone measures it, then that is clinging. Because of this attainment, he should receive support and respect. If advancing in this way, he attains the true Dharma without praising himself or looking down on others, then this is the nature of a true person. Monks, this is what is meant by the nature of a true person and the nature of an untrue person. You should know the nature of a true person and the nature of an untrue person. Having known the nature of a true person and the nature of an untrue person, discard and become separated from the nature of an untrue person and train in the nature of a true person. You should train like this. So I'm just giving you here the lists of potential objects of conceit and ego in the Pali version. First we get four different types of family, and I think that here they may have gone something wrong with transmission, because the actual meaning of these are not so different from each other. A high family, a great family, a vastly wealthy family, and a highly wealthy family. Then somebody is famous, gains requisites, is learned. This is just a single quality here. Knows the Vinaya, preaches the Dharma, dwells in the forest, wears rag robes, begs for food, dwells at a tree root, dwells in a cemetery, dwells out in the open, never lies down. This is one of the ascetic practices, never lying down. They sit, even for sleeping, they keep seated. Use any bed, take a single meal, then attain first to fourth jhana, first to fourth immaterial attainment, and the cessation attainment. Cessation attainment is not mentioned in the Madhyama Agama version. And in relation to this attainment, the Pali version makes it clear that the untrue person will not even be able, the Asapurisa will not be able to attain it. The formulation implicitly indicates that cessation attainment is something that only the Sapurisa will be able to attain. And traditionally it is held to require insight up to the development of non-return and mastery of the four jhanas and the four immaterial attainments. Yeah, so the main point of this discourse, as far as I can see, is to avoid conceit and to give priority to the Dharma, to the practice. And this again ties in with this whole issue so strongly debated sometimes about attainment, and the beautiful comment that we had from Shaila Catherine on this on the significance of jhana, and accelerated with minor attainments, meditators risk overestimating the significance and durability of their experiences. Tinged by conceit, meditators seek recognition. And that the real point of jhana is not about attaining experience, but about developing the mind. John Emmer has a question. Is this immeasurable the same as in Anguttara Nikaya 280, translated as for inconceivable matters, domain of Buddhas, domain in jhana, result of karma and speculation about the world? No, the inconceivable matters are the four achintayani. And this is not the term that we have here. Let me just check. You gave Anguttara Nikaya 280. Yeah, the four achintayani are things not fit for reflection, because to try to think them out will only lead to mental confusion or even madness. And I think here the point is more that where do we have the immeasurable? Yeah, that the first absorption is immeasurable. That would be apamana. I just have to check what the if we have that in the Pali version. Dhammakatiko, pindapatiko, rukamuliko, nisajiko, patamanyo. Atammayata, yes, it's atammayata in the Pali. That's a very powerful term. Atammayata. Patama jhana samapatiya piko atammayata vutanta bhagavata. Yena yena himanyati tato tang hoti anyata. Tammaya comes from tatmaya, made of lead, and so it has this sense that it's a very beautiful and profound term, and I'm a little bit scared of not giving it the proper place, but it has this, it gives to me this feeling of I experience something, like I experience an absorption, or I know something, and I'm making this my own, and I become made of that. We have Venerable Jnana Nanda has explained this in his Nibbana sermons. We have the expressions Rajamaya, made of silver. Tatmaya, I am made of that. And so Attamaya, don't be made of that, which I would say, don't create a sense of identity out of the fact that you have attained the first absorption. Don't make it something that creates an ego, a sense of identity, but make it something that becomes a tool for the progress towards the eradication of identity, to let go of the sense of I. And Chinese is clearly based on a different original or a misunderstanding of the similar origin in the Indic, because immeasurable cannot translate tamaya. And it has this contrast between immeasurable and if someone measures, then that is clinging. It seems to me, as you brought this up, John, thank you very much, that I like the immeasurable. It's like the experience is so vast, and now you make it something very small by clinging to it. But the tamayata is such a powerful term in the Pali discourses that if I had to choose between the two, I would prefer the Pali. Attamayata. Don't be made of that. Don't make it part of your ego. Don't use it to construct a sense of ego. And then yena himanyanti tatvatang hoti anitya. However you conceptualize it, it will anyway be otherwise. And so attamayata iva antaram karitva, yeah. So making this attamayata, this not fashioning, making, giving that priority. Taya patama jhana samapati ani attan ukhangsina parang bhammeti. The practitioner does not elevate himself or put down others because of attainment of the first absorption. Ayam bibhikave sappampurisa dhammo. This is the nature of a true person. Beautiful. Attamayata. There's also, it doesn't matter. Akinchana or Frikar, if you have any questions, then if you can type that into the chat box, that would be the way, then I will reply to it. Attamayata. Very powerful term. Yeah, so the whole thing that I think we can take along is precisely this attamayata, not that meditation experiences, meditation techniques that somebody finds useful, meditation teachers that we might relate to, attamayata, they should not become building blocks of our sense of ego that used to create a sense of I am mine, but should all be made provisions for the journey to liberation from conceit, to liberation from clinging. Yeah, now we come to the last discourse, and this is a discourse without a parallel. And I also think it's probably late. And it has no direct bearing to our topic of tranquility and insight. but I quickly go through it and then we round off with Tranquility Insight. So at that time, the Venerable Ananda rose from sitting in meditation in the afternoon and led a company of young monks to the Buddha. He paid homage at the Buddha's feet, stepped back and stood to one side, and the young monks also paid homage at the Buddha's feet, stepped back and sat to one side. The Venerable Ananda said, "Blessed One, how should I teach these young monks? How should I instruct them? How should I explain the Dharma to them?" And so the Buddha gives him several topics. The first is, Blessed One said, "Ananda, I have earlier explained to you the five aggregates of clinging, the aggregate of clinging of form, feeling, of perception, formations, and the aggregate of clinging of consciousness. Ananda, you should explain and teach these five aggregates of clinging to the young monks. If you explain and teach these five aggregates of clinging to the young monks, they will obtain ease, they will obtain strength and happiness, they will be untroubled in body and mind, and they will practice the holy life for as long as they live." And so the discourse now continues in the same way with all these other topics, altogether 30 topics. So we get the six senses, then the sense objects, the corresponding consciousness, contact, feeling, perception, intention, craving. Then the six elements, the four elements and space and consciousness. Then dependent arising, the 12 links. Then the four establishments of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four bases for supernormal ability, idipada, the four absorptions, the four noble truths, the four perceptions, the four boundless states, dhammana, the four immaterial attainments, the four noble traditions, ariyavamsa, the four fruits of recluseship, the five perceptions, five spheres of liberation, five faculties, five powers, five elements of release, seven types of spiritual wealth, seven powers, seven awakening factors, noble eightfold path, and the summit of the Dharma, which refers to the three characteristics. The discourse is interesting in so far as it shows a tendency of building up lists, matikas, and these lists have had a considerable influence on the evolving Abhidharma. In fact, the Japanese scholar Watanabe has already pointed out that many of the topics we get in this list here in this discourse are chapter headings in the Dharma Skanda, the first book of the Sarvastivada Abhidharma. It needs, however, be mentioned that the matikas, these short summary lists, are not in themselves necessarily Abhidharma. The probably earliest and most important instance of a matika or matrika, a summary list, is actually the Patimokkha, the code of rules for monks and nuns. And this had a very important role in the oral setting in the early Buddhist community, because it is by reciting the Patimokkha in a community that communal harmony is expressed, and community is also defined as a type of identity, as somebody who does not belong to the community, who is being dismissed from the community, no longer participates in that recital. So we have to be careful of not thinking that the bare fact of the usage of such lists automatically makes something Abhidharma. Nevertheless, I think there is a point in seeing discourses like this, and well-known examples in the Pali Canon would be the Sangiti and Dasuttara Sutta of the Digha-Nikaya, the last two, are pointing in the direction of the evolving Abhidharma. Thangpo Wai, please explain what the four noble traditions are. The four Ariyavamsa, I hope I remember them now, there are four forms of conduct. Yeah, I can't recall them offhand exactly. Yes, contentedness with robes, alms food, dwelling, and delight in meditation. The two usages, traditions, forms of conduct that are esteemed by noble ones and that in some way also conduce to becoming noble. That is, one is contented with any kind of clothing one has, One is contented with whatever food one receives. One is contented with whatever dwelling. And one is seriously dedicated to the practice of meditation and cultivating the mind. So, after this little excursion into the Abhidharma, there's something from Akinchano. Thanks for speaking about Attammayata. I'd be delighted to hear more about it. My center is named that way. An interesting article that probes into the term is from Sferra Francesco, Attammayata in the Pali Nikayas. I think I've read that one a long time ago. Yeah, Akinchano, Attammayata is a little bit discussed in The Island, which I suppose you probably know, the publication by the Western. Yeah, but there's a number of really nice references to it in Venerable Jnanananda's Nibbana sermons, and they are listed in the index, and I found this particularly useful. And he speaks of this is a topic that he's very good at, this type of topic, and the Nibbana sermons by Venerable Jnanananda are available on the internet. In fact, I'm the one who transcribed them. He lives in a cave in Sri Lanka, and he just has this tape recorder and just did the. This is a series of 33 talks given on the topic of Nibbana by a very advanced meditator and former university lecturer. And it's a little difficult to read. He has his own style, and he uses a lot of Pali also. But for somebody who has some familiarity with Pali, they're very, very powerful, especially on issues like Attammayata. He is very good. And I can just check the references and send them to you if I have your email somewhere. It's a very, very powerful term, and it was very nice that John made me find that this term is actually there in the Pali version. Attammayata. There's some remark from Kim Allen that I wanted to put in, but there I see. Yeah, Akinchan, okay. So I'll send that to you. Akinchan Na or Freakard, if you have anything. Well, maybe I do first what I wanted to say, and then we see if there are still some more questions. This is Kim Allen again from the forum, and I thought this is a very beautiful remark for us to conclude this series of discussions we had together. There's Frikard. Aryavamsa, according to Dictionary of Pali, proper names is at Anguttara Nikaya 227. In medieval it was recited at religious festivals. Yeah, thank you very much. Very quick to find the references. Wow. Must have had the book right there in front of you. So this is from Kim Allen. She says, I find it interesting that when we began with the Yogananda Sutta many weeks ago, we spent a long time talking about the third option presented, that of developing tranquility and insight together. It appeared vaguer or more confusing than the first two options, insight preceded by tranquility and tranquility preceded by insight. And yet, when I look back on the suttas we studied, it seems to be quite universal. Many of the MA versions, as well as the Pali ones, clearly weave tranquility and insight into a mutually supporting holistic practice that issues in liberation when undertaken wisely. Yeah, thank you, Kim, for this beautiful summary. This resonates very much with my understanding. And if this has come through in these discourses that we read and in these sessions that we had together, that tranquility and insight are mutually supporting holistic practices, and that when undertaken wisely, they issue liberation, then I'm very glad, very happy. I think this is really the point. So I think at this point we can conclude a little earlier. A few other times, I mean, there's 5 more minutes to go, but a few other times we have overdone. So I think I would like to conclude on this beautiful remark by Kim. And yeah, thanks to all of you for listening, commenting, thinking with me, being with me in this little journey into the discourses, and to get a better understanding, a deepened understanding of tranquility and insight in the way they are described in the early discourses. And hope to see you next year.